we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
Welcome to Hard Facts, the show that gets to the heart of the matter with me, John White. One of the most moving and inspirational experiences I have ever had in politics came in 2003 when I saw for the first time the documentary The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. It was filmed by a team of Irish filmmakers who had travelled to Venezuela to record the remarkable transformation that was underway under the auspices of the Bolivarian Revolution, inspired by the country's president Hugo Chavez, who was elected in 1998 and took office in 1999. And given the region, and in particular Venezuela, which for generations had been, well, let's call it as it is, a wholly owned subsidiary of the United States, its oil wealth in the hands of a clutch of oligarchs and private economic interests, it really was a remarkable transformation. For the first time, Venezuela's working class and poor were at the forefront of a political program with the intent of transforming their situation and improving their lives and elevating their cultural level and expectations of what life had to offer. Now, unsurprisingly, Hugo Chavez was widely depicted as a dictator, as a tyrant in the West, especially in Washington. So let us just depart for a moment to look at some of the achievements of this tyrant, Hugo Chavez, during his time in power in Venezuela. Everything I'm about to read to you is both authentic and verifiable. Never in the history of Latin America has a political leader had such incontestable democratic legitimacy. Since coming to power in 1999, there were 16 elections in Venezuela. Hugo Chavez won 15, the last on October 7th, 2012. He defeated his rivals with a margin of between 10 and 20 percentage points. All international bodies, from the European Union to the Organization of American States to the Union of South American Nations and the Carter Center, were unanimous in recognizing the transparency of these votes and these elections. Universal access to education was introduced in 1998 and had exceptional results. About 1.5 million Venezuelans learned to read and write thanks to the literacy campaign under the name of Mission Robinson One. In December 2005, UNESCO said that Venezuela had eradicated illiteracy. The number of children attending school increased from 6 million in 1998 to 13 million in 2011. With regard to health, Venezuela created the national public system to ensure free access to healthcare for all Venezuelans. And between 2005 and 2012, 7,873 new medical centres were created in Venezuela. The infant mortality rate fell from 19.1 per thousand in 1999 to 10 per thousand by 2012, a reduction of 49%. Now, I could go on and on and on, but by now you should be getting the idea. What took place in Venezuela was, well, it was miraculous. Now, fast forward 18 years and we see a country that is in the clutches of a full-blown social, political and economic crisis, typified by shortages of food in supermarkets, the shortages of basic medicine, inflation climbing up towards 1,000%, reports of corruption in the army, the breakdown of social cohesion, one of the highest murder rates, if not the highest murder rate in the Western Hemisphere, and accusations of government mismanagement of resources. That's what the media would have you believe. The media would have you believe that what is happening in Venezuela today bears all the hallmarks of another failed socialist experiment. Bunkum. Hear me well, this is bunkum. What is happening in Venezuela is a full-blown, as the President Nicolas Maduro called it, economic war. The oligarchs want their country back, and they are intent on destabilizing the country with the support of Washington and with the compliance of the Western media and the opposition media in the country. I'm John White and you're listening to another episode of Hard Facts. Well, I'm delighted to be joined for this special episode on Venezuela, on the Venezuelan crisis, by Francisco Dominguez. Francisco is a volunteer with the Venezuela Solidarity Campaign, and he's also the head of Latin American Studies Research Group at Middlesex University. Francisco, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
One thing I failed to mention in my introduction, because it's key to the economic crisis, and that's the vertiginous collapse in oil prices that has taken place since 2014. Price of crude has gone down between 2014 and 2016 by 75%, which has obviously had a deleterious impact on a country which derives 95% of its export revenue from oil. Now, there are two explanations for this collapse in oil prices. The first, the more official explanation, was averred by Yassine Fawaz, a journalist for Forbes magazine, back in January 2016. And he said it's because of the Saudis are flooding the market with cheap oil, fearing the ramifications of the increasing departure and the increasing moves to move away from reliance on fossil fuels and hydrocarbons, which embodied in the Paris Climate Change Agreement of 2015. So they believe that they want to try and garner as much revenue as they can and to compete with the new sources of fuel that are coming on board, shale gas, etc., renewables, in order to make sure that they manage to transform what would otherwise be a dead commodity into a live one. That's the official, or the more official, more mainstream explanation of what's taking place. A less official one is one that was promulgated by Russia's President Vladimir Putin in late 2014, when Putin said, and I quote, "There's a lot of talk about what's causing the plunge in oil prices. Could it be the agreement between the US and Saudi Arabia to punish Iran and affect the economies of Russia and Venezuela? It could." End quote. Your thoughts, please.
I think the main reason for the collapse in the oil prices was the result of fracking. You're right that Saudi Arabia and others actually flout the agreements of OPEC, and they produce more than what they should according to the regular agreements that the organization has. But the main reason was a political or geopolitical decision by the United States, by Barack Obama, to actually hit as hard as possible the oil-dependent economies of Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. These three countries depend on oil in different levels, Venezuela much more than any of the other two. And the idea was to actually make the price of oil plunge by engaging in fracking, which actually has saturated the world market in the following way. Fracking has led the United States to be able to produce, to increase in production from 4 million barrels of oil a day, something like 4 or 5 years ago, to something like 10 million of barrels a day now. The result of this has been a complete saturation, and the price of oil, which at the highest was in 2008 at $148 a barrel, plunged to something like $20 a barrel a few years ago, 2 or 3 years ago. The result was the economy of Venezuela was hit extremely hard. That's one of the reasons why Venezuela is in trouble. So I want to tell you a bit more about the rest of the economic war, if I may.
Before you do, can I just enter this point, because I think this is also important. We've heard a lot, obviously, about the food shortages and the shortages of basic medicines and other essentials. Now, it has been claimed that private interests in Venezuela control the distribution networks, and they've been purposely hoarding food when they've arrived, because Venezuela imports the vast majority of its food and medicines. And they've been using their control of these distribution networks and imports to try and destabilize the country and effect what I mentioned as an economic war. But I believe that in July of 2016, Nicolas Maduro deployed the army to take control of 5 key ports in the country so that they now controlled the food distribution and the imports when they came in, so that nefarious characters and nefarious groups were no longer able to try and hoard the food and to divert it to other places. I believe there's claims have been diverted to Brazil and Colombia and so forth. But we're now hearing reports of corruption in the army, that the army or elements within the armed forces are actually doing the same as what the private interests were doing in hoarding some of the food and selling it on the black market. Is there some veracity to these claims?
Well, I think you have to understand that the context is conducive for all sorts of corruption taking place at very many levels. I think it would be impossible for, you know, the army not to be affected in some way. However, the bulk of the army has remained absolutely loyal to the principles of the Bolivarian Revolution and to the government. Venezuela has been subjected to something similar to what Salvador Allende was subjected back in the 1970s.
Sorry, just for the listeners who remember, Salvador Allende was a democratically elected president of Chile in the 1970s, a democratic socialist, and obviously there was a coup there in 1973 that was supported by the US, which brought to power Augusto Pinochet. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, the Chile was subjected to a very similar, almost identical economic war. A hoarding of basic necessities was taking place at massive levels. And this was compounded by a very severe economic blockade imposed by the United States through his influence and control over international credit institutions such as the World Bank, the IMF, and so on. Even worse than that, similar to fracking, at the time, the United States threw a huge amount of its copper reserves into the world market. Chile is the largest producer of oil in the world, and at the time, though, of copper in the world. And at the time, with the Vietnam War, the price of copper was very high. And the United States, by throwing its reserves into the world market, made the price of copper plunge in a similar fashion. Plus, you know, very massive and very intense program of destabilization, which involved bombs, assassination of people, hoardings, financing, strikes and so on. Venezuela is subjected to the same thing. In that context, what you actually create is hyperinflation because this shortage of goods leads to massive prices. And as a result of that, it is convenient and it's worth risking, if I may say that, they may say it in that way, it's worth risking engaging in corruption. So it is inevitably a context in which many people are going to be affected.
I'd like to return to the documentary I mentioned, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, because as these Irish filmmakers were filming and covering and following Hugo Chavez around the country and recording the social transformation that was underway, they could never imagine that they would have found themselves in the midst of a full-blown coup that was carried out by disloyal army officers, private interests, the oligarchs, and it was supported by the US, which succeeded temporarily in toppling Hugo Chavez. We remember the scenes in the presidential palace in Caracas, the Miraflores, where he was abducted and taken off to an island by military officers. A new president was announced, was sworn in. The Bolivarian constitution was peremptorily abolished. But then something remarkable took place. And that is when the word got out that Hugo Chavez had not resigned, as had been claimed by these plotters. Tens of thousands of Venezuelans poured down from the barrios, the poor, the masses, a risen people, and they surrounded the presidential palace and demanded that their president be returned to his rightful place at the head of the country. There was a remarkable and beautiful synergy between the masses, members of the army, ordinary soldiers in the presidential palace, and obviously members of Hugo Chavez's cabinet. And that really brought home to me the power of the socialist transformation that was underway. And it seemed to mark a departure in a region that had long been ravaged by right-wing dictatorships, proto-fascist governments, military juntas. And I compared it at the time to what took place in 1973, we just mentioned with Salvador Allende, who perished in that horrible and tragic coup that was led by the proto-fascist dictator Augusto Pinochet. And it seemed to me this was now gone. Those days were gone, that the right were not going to get their way, that fascism had been expelled from Latin America. And look at the impact that Hugo Chavez had across the region. It was said that before Hugo Chavez came to power in Venezuela, that it was impossible for a left-wing politician to be elected, while after he was elected, it was impossible for a left-wing politician not to be elected in Latin America. We saw left-of-centre governments in Argentina, Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia, of course. What's the impact of what's taking place now in Venezuela regionally? What is happening regionally with regard to this crisis in Venezuela?
Well, what you have is a counteroffensive by the US against, you know, these progressive governments in the region. The conditions that actually allow the United States to be successful, certainly in the case of Argentina and in Brazil, is the economic crisis that actually hit the world, economic crisis that hit the world in 2007, 2008. This created massive problems of budget constraints, difficulties of financing, losses in revenues to the nations and so on, mainly because these countries depend very heavily on the exportation of primary products, particularly raw materials. In the case of Brazil, it was mainly iron, but in the case of Argentina, it was mainly meat and soya and so on. And these countries were subjected to easily, in the case of Argentina, 4 years of massive program of destabilization plus everything else that we know, including deployment of the vulture funds, bankers who actually didn't settle the external debt of Argentina in the past when Argentina told the IMF to go someplace and decided to actually pay what it required to pay by resettling and recalculating the debt, except for these very few vulture fund bankers who insisted on this, and they used them against the country and destabilized it financially in the context of an economic crisis, is very effective. And the same was done to Brazil. And as a result of this economic crisis, the United States has been able to take advantage of the social and economic difficulties that the economic crisis creates in these nations in order to destabilize them. And it's been successful by being able to get the right-wing forces to oust President Dilma Rousseff in Brazil recently, and by being able to put together a coalition of right-wing politicians who defeated the Peronists in Argentina. Now we have Macri, who is a right-wing elected president, who both of them, in the case of Brazil and Argentina, are applying one of the most savage neoliberal programs against the population that you have seen in decades. And this is the context. So therefore, the situation is, from their point of view, in terms of the geopolitics, they need to sort out Venezuela. And this is where they fail quite dramatically, because despite Venezuela being subjected to, at least by now, 3 to 4 years of economic warfare of unprecedented levels. Last year, particularly 2016, was possibly the worst year that the revolution actually went through. It's come out victorious, and it's come out quite strengthened as a result of being able to resist this, attack.
Let's hold it there, Francisco. I'd love to hear your analysis of how these attacks are being resisted in Venezuela. We're going to stop for a short break. Please join us for the second half of this show and what has been already a fascinating discussion. Hard facts. Welcome back to the second half of this episode of Hard Facts. We are discussing the crisis in Venezuela with Francisco Dominguez, who is a volunteer with the Venezuela Solidarity Campaign, and he is head of the Latin American Studies Research Group at Middlesex University. Now, Francisco, before we broke, you talked about the way that these attacks were being resisted, but can I just say one thing? I do have to say, and I've long been a supporter of Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution, but with the benefit of hindsight, and I stress it is with the benefit of hindsight, I do have some criticisms of the Bolivarian leadership, and I have some criticisms, I have to say, of Hugo Chavez, and my criticisms are this. After the coup was overturned, he should have come down on those responsible and who took part in the coup like the proverbial ton of bricks. He had a mandate, and I think, in hindsight, as I say, he should have understood that this was not the end, but only the end of the beginning, and that these people would not go away. And I think at that space, that window of opportunity, in hindsight, was lost. I think he stuck too hard and fast to trying to make this a transparent and a mass participatory democracy. I think, obviously, he understood the external pressures in this regard. Regardless, I think this was a moment when he should have clamped down on these forces. He did so with the oil strike, which was carried out at the behest of these, when the oil company was still in the control of private interests, and they tried to destabilise the country by placing a de facto embargo on oil exports. But I think he should have clamped down really hard on the coup plotters, given what was at stake. What are your thoughts on that, please?
Well, he himself talked about this at the time, or later on. And he said the following. He said that his calculation was the following. Had he come down like a ton of bricks on the people who perpetrated the coup, he very likely would have actually produced a division in the army. And by adopting the policy that he adopted, that isolated the coup plotters within the armed forces, who actually have to resign and were easily retired by him. And many of them went to Miami. And as a result of that, the transformation of the armed forces ever since up to now has been, almost complete. You don't have another army or armed forces in the region, except in Cuba, of course, that is committed to a socialist revolution with that level of degree. And therefore,
The army remains solid behind the Bolivarian Revolution, despite the difficulties that are taking place.
Look, it's 17 years of imperial onslaught. It's 17 years of attack. It's 17 years of attempt to bribe. It's 17 years of trying to get generals to defect. It's 17 years of every imaginable trick in the book. And in 17 years, what they got so far is pretty little. I mean, one officer here, one dissenter over there, but the bulk of the armed forces, from the commander-in-chief all the way down to the last soldiers, have remained absolutely solid behind the government. I think, therefore, his political calculation, his political strategic calculation, Chavez's, at the time of the coup, it turned out to be correct. I mean, from the point of view of ethics and morality, I agree with you. You know, anybody who perpetrates such an attack against democracy of the people of any country by that level should be dealt with very, very harshly. But however, you have to take into consideration other factors which are important. The survival of the revolution depend very heavily on his decisions. And he was absolutely correct in doing what he did.
Well, I guess that's why Hugo Chavez led one of the most miraculous revolutions in modern history, and I have not. On the subject of resistance on the ground amongst the Bolivarian circles that were set up to support the revolution and the people at large, how is that manifesting? Because obviously the country's National Congress is now under the control of the opposition parties. This came about from the 2015 elections that were held. So how is this resistance in defence of the Bolivarian revolution taking place on the ground?
Well, I think there is a very interesting context. The opposition won the 2015 election to the National Assembly, and they nearly got 2/3 majority. And the main reason for this was the economic war against the country that led to discontent, which meant that, you know, about 2 million Chavistas who had voted for the government before abstained. And that's what produced the majority. It's not that the opposition won too many votes. In fact, if you look at the votes that the opposition got in 2013, which was 7.4 million votes when they lost to Nicolas Maduro, in 2015, in the National Assembly elections in December, they got 7.7 million votes. In other words, they increased by less than 4%. Imagine if you launch an economic war against a government of that nature, you know, for 2 years, 3 years at least, and the result is that you increase your vote by less than 4%, even though some people abstain. This is not too effective. And ever since Maduro has been organizing, since January 2016, has been organizing the resistance. And there are many, many committees. There are many organizations, grassroots organizations, communal councils, Bolivarian circles. There are women organizations, peasant organizations. The Bolivarian Trade Union Federation is as big as ever. It organizes, it mobilizes people all over the place. And what they have as an advantage in terms of defending themselves from Maduro all the way down to the last Chavista in Venezuela is the Constitution. It is very difficult to legitimize any action against the government in terms of trying to oust him without actually being constitutional about it, which is not what the, you know, coup plotters enjoyed in Chile. In Chile, there was a Ujo constitution, and they used it, and they were able to get away with it, even though they had to assassinate the president in order to be able to carry it out. But in the case of Venezuela, for example, the recall referendum, which is a mechanism that they're trying to use, they failed to produce enough votes, and as a result of that, they decided to abandon it. They actually thought about the possibility of organizing a new constituent assembly, which they were entitled to, given that they have a majority in the National Assembly, and one of the constitutional prerogatives of the Constitution, the National Assembly, is to actually call for a constituent assembly, which would have led to the creation or the promulgation of a new constitution. But they, in order for them to be able to do this, they needed to actually organize a referendum. And if they were, they decided not to go for that because they were not sure that they will win it. So every single time there's been an attempt of doing anything, they don't. And I think the key is this. Every time the interest of privateers enter into contradiction with the interest of the people, then the interest of the people actually prevail. And I'll give you an example. One company which actually decided to sabotage production And the workers denounced this to the government. And they asked the government to take, you know, firm action. And the government said, you tell me what to do and I'll do it. And the workers said, we want to take it over and we want you to take charge of it. And the company was taken over. And Maduro immediately after that said, any company that engages in sabotage is a company that is going to be taken over by the workers. And this became a slogan of the working class in Venezuela. So although they're still engaged in sabotage and all sort of other shenanigans, their constraints are quite enormous. And as a result of this year of, you know, huge warfare, the revolution has been able to survive quite, I would say, strengthened, despite the complications.
I'm going to have to cut in because we're running out of time. I just want to touch upon quickly the role of the media in what's going on in Venezuela and the way it's being supported by the US. And as a caveat, when anybody listening to this discussion and understanding what's going on in Venezuela and the role of Washington and what's going on, whenever now they hear accusations of Russia being involved in the US election, presidential election, and interfering in US internal affairs, just consider the role of the US in Venezuela and consider how the hypocrisy of these people. Because Eva Gollinger, the Venezuelan independent journalist, she uncovered in 2007 a program that was set up by the US, by the State Department, called the International Business Leadership Program, which had many mainstream opposition Venezuelan journalists being paid to go to the US and study ways to undermine the Bolivarian revolution through their influence in the media. Your thoughts on that, please, quickly.
85% or about 85% of the media in Venezuela is controlled by the right wing. They lie literally every single day. They demonize it. And the main problem we have with that is that the international media, the mainstream international media, actually echoes everything that the opposition said. What you actually get in terms of reporting and journalism about Venezuela is what the right-wing opposition media in Venezuela says, literally about everything. The idea that Venezuela is a dictatorship is just incredibly ridiculous. It's preposterous.
Francisco, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We're right out of time. Thank you for your participation, and thank you out there for listening to yet another episode of Hard Facts. Please join us again next week.
My pleasure.